I'm delighted to welcome Bill Ayers. He's an author, retired professor of education, co-founder of the Weather Underground. His new book is Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. He'll be speaking this evening at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
So, you were a passionate protester against the Vietnam War. You worked with the Weather Underground, which was considered by some people to be a terrorist organization, though it didn't kill or injure a single person, did a bunch of property damage. In retrospect, do you think that the Weather Underground had any success in ending the Vietnam War?
Well, one of the things that I think is difficult for all of us who were engaged in both the Black Freedom Movement and the anti-Vietnam War movement in the 60s is that we have to somehow face the fact that we neither ended white supremacy nor did we end the war, and those were our most modest goals. So it's very hard for me to assess what the impact of either the student demonstrations, which I was deeply involved in as a leader of Students for a Democratic Society, nor the sit-ins, nor the mass mobilizations, nor the actions of the Weather Underground. It's hard for me to make any kind of causal claim. What I try to do in my first memoir, Fugitive Days, and once again here in Public Enemy, is describe what it was like for a young person set down in that particular landscape, making his way without benefit of hindsight, and trying to figure out how to do the right thing in terms of peace and social justice. I don't think the things we did were brilliant or perfect, and certainly I think all of us have to come to terms with the fact that while the American people turned against the war in 3 years, by about 1968, if you think of the American invasion and occupation beginning in 1965, by 68, a majority of Americans opposed the war, and of course an overwhelming majority of people around the world, but we couldn't stop it, and it dragged on for 7 more years, and every week that it went on, 6,000 people were killed needlessly. So it was a tragedy of huge proportions and a crisis for democracy and a crisis for the anti-war movement. Let me correct one thing that you said in introduction. You say we never killed or injured anyone. The fact is that the Weather Underground was born with the deaths of our three comrades who killed themselves in a
right.
townhouse explosion. And that's a focus of, you know, both terrible, terrible memories and concern and, you know, kind of a grief that never ends. But from that point on, what we did, the Weather Underground did, was intentional property destruction, a kind of what we thought of as a kind of, we sometimes said armed propaganda, we sometimes said moral theater, but it wasn't an attempt to hurt anybody, and it was an attempt to raise a screaming alarm about the war and to destroy property in the service of that alarm.
So after that period, you went underground for about a decade, as you write about in the memoir Fugitive Days, and ultimately charges against you were dropped, but you remained a target of some factions of the right wing, and this escalated in this unbelievable way during the presidential primary debates of 2008, which sets the stage for the new book. What happened?
Well, you know, it's true that, I mean, I've been, I've been a public person and a person, you know, identified with radical protests since the mid-1960s, but nothing could prepare anyone for what it means to be thrown into, both unwittingly and unwillingly, thrown into a presidential campaign. It's such a gigantic, mega media storm. And what happened, I mean, I describe in the opening of the book the kind of moment when I had my graduate students over for dinner and seminar, which we often did. My wife's a law professor, I was an education professor, and we often had seminar in our home. And one April night in 2008, I had about 15 of my graduate students over, and as seminar was ending, somebody turned on the TV, and it was the tail end of the debate between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and George Stephanopoulos was kind of bearing down on Obama about his associations, his friendships, and he was talking about Reverend Jeremiah Wright, and then he turned and talked about me, and he said, what about your relationship with Bill Ayers? He's, you know, was involved in Weather Underground. He's never apologized for those things. How is that going to play with the voters? And I thought Obama looked somewhat stricken. I know I was stricken. My students, kind of their heads snapped in my direction. A couple of them fell on the floor. And after Obama answered, one of my students turned to me and said, "Oh my God, that guy has the same name as yours," which struck us all as hilarious because then somebody pointed out that's because we were indeed the same guy. But it, you know, she would have no way of knowing. She was 28 years old, and suddenly we all realized that, you know, I was being put into this kind of campaign in a way that was unpredictable and unanticipated, and there we were. So that's how it began, and you're right. I mean, the threats, which continue to this day, kind of escalated, and the Weather Underground became more notorious, more famous than it ever was before, and that was kind of ironic and strange, but it was not in any service of either understanding what went on back then or understanding what that phenomenon was or who I was. It was in the service of bringing down candidate Barack Obama. And it failed miserably. It failed for Hillary Clinton, and then it was picked up, you know, by the McCain-Palin forces, and Palin came up with that deathless phrase, palling around with terrorists, and that kind of has stuck ever since. But it's not how I see myself, and in many ways it was a distraction and a diversion from what I really do.
During that period, there were a lot of people who recognized you and said, "Oh, let me get my picture taken with you," and then said, "And now I can never be president." Yes. And later in the book, you sort of muse, "Well, I guess they could."
Yeah, exactly, because it still happens. I mean, I was speaking, where was I? I was in Austin, Texas, at a bookstore, and several young people wanted to have their pictures taken with me and with Bernadine, and they remarked, "Oh my gosh, I guess I can't run for president." I said, "Don't forget, he was elected president, and maybe this will be on your campaign poster. Who knows? Maybe I helped him." I mean, I was just being facetious. Of course, that's not true. But the idea that somehow I was the poison in the campaign is, I think, proved to be nonsense. People didn't take it seriously or saw the desperation in Obama's opponents and ignored it. And I think there's a lot of ironies like this. I write about the fact that, you know, as the campaign wound down and the attacks on Obama in 2008 were intensifying, there was a poll taken of young Americans under 25, and over 50% had a positive view of socialism. And I thought, my goodness, you know, they keep calling Obama a socialist, and some kid in Wyoming goes on the internet and Googles it and says, "Oh, socialism, from each according to his ability, not bad." You know, it's almost biblical. And those things always happen. I mean, that the intention of the attack was one thing. I think the result was something quite different.
It also points out how, I mean, not only desperate were various politicians to try to score points by associating Obama with you, but also how pathetic the media were in really picking up on that rather than ever addressing really substantive issues.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's one of the real tragedies of the moment we're living in. The great thing is that we have access to alternative forms of media and an entire kind of smorgasbord of opportunities to get information. And I think young people take advantage of that, and I think that's great. But I think the tragedy of the media is that it has lost its way around the fundamental idea that the media is there as the fifth estate. It's there to keep government and corporations honest. It's there to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, and it's lost its way in that regard. So the real bad part of this campaign in 2008 was not just the demonization of Jeremiah Wright, who incidentally is a brilliant scholar and theologian and pillar of the Chicago community, as well as a real leader nationally and internationally. The demonization of Rashid Khalidi, the brilliant Palestinian scholar, the demonization of me, all of that is bad, but it's not the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem is guilt by association, which has a long and tragic history in this country, and the kind of willingness of the media to not kind of go deeper. So when somebody in the media was interviewing a McCain official in Florida, and the McCain official said Obama has anti-Semitic friends like Rashid Khalidi, the CNN guy didn't say, "Well, let me look into that. Is Rashid Khalidi anti-Semitic? What's the basis of that charge? I mean, okay, he has an Arab name, but is that enough?" And it turns out, the way it was reported, that is enough. And that's absurd.
We're talking to Bill Ayers about his memoir, Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. So suddenly you were, I mean, you'd already been in some kind of factions of Public Enemy, but suddenly you were much more public, and all sorts of things happened, from continual death threats to canceled speaking engagements everywhere, even from people who you thought might have defended you or been your allies, and then some people did defend you and your ideas and the right to free speech. How did you handle all that craziness? Because it seemed to be coming at you from both right-wing people and from liberals.
Yeah, I think the liberals, many liberals who were very committed to Obama's election, were frightened that somehow I would be either a distraction or someone who could derail Obama. And so they, too, kind of joined in, and that was somewhat disappointing. But I have to say, you know, in the larger scheme of things, this it didn't exactly go past me unnoticed, but it didn't actually derail me. It didn't impact me in a way that that was tragic or horrible. I mean, my kids, I have three grown kids. I have a brilliant partner of 44 years. I have a family that I love and that loves me. And I never kind of lost, I don't know, the grounding that my kids and my partner and my brothers give me. So during the whole thing, my kids kept saying, just be quiet. Don't talk to the media. You'll be fine. Just keep your head down. Don't pay attention. And in some ways, I didn't even notice what was on the news because I stopped reading or looking at the news unless my kids sent me something. And so they'd send me a clip from Saturday Night Live where I was a character, or from Stephen Colbert. And then I'd know that I was somewhere, not I, and this is important, I would know that this character, this cartoon named Bill Ayers was in the media. But I didn't take it personally, and I didn't think it was about me. And partly that's a result of being a lot older than I'm almost 70, and back then I was, 65 or something. And so in some ways that was helpful. And in some ways, having been through this kind of thing on a lesser scale before, death threats and anger, and after 9/11, when Fugitive Days was published, and so I've been through it before. And then I would get these moments of glimmering encouragement. I was canceled at the University of Wyoming. I took a deep breath and said, onward, and kind of moved on. And a week later, I got a call from a student who was a young woman who just returned from the military, and she was attending the University of Wyoming, and she said, I'm going to sue them in federal court, not because I'm worried about your free speech, but because they're violating my free speech. And I thought that was kind of brilliant. She was saying, look, I have a right to talk to anyone I want to, read any book I want to. Talking to you isn't supporting you. I just want to talk. And she did sue in federal court, and a conservative federal judge enjoined the university, and I went and spoke. And the irony of that incident was that I'd have probably had 30 students had there not been a big ruckus about canceling me. And instead, I had about 1,500 students. So it was a bizarre turn of events. But that kind of irony has been happening again and again.
You write about liberal cowardice and hypocrisy. What are some examples from your experience of what that looks like?
Well, I don't want to overstate it, and I don't want to, you know, get too personal or ad hominem with anybody. But the fact is that again and again, we find ourselves, and everybody does, you know, we all think that we would do the moral thing, the right thing, the just thing, if any kind of blacklisting came along. If they were burning witches, we all know what to do. If somebody came along and said, my name's Joe McCarthy, I want a list, we all know what to do. The tricky part is knowing what to do when it's happening to you right now, right here, and the framework of it happening is less clear than it becomes with kind of 20/20 hindsight when you're looking back in history. So, for example, the cancellation of a speaker, and in this case me, but I don't want to, again, make it too personal, but if a university gets threats about bringing a certain speaker to campus and the university collapses, that is a horrible, terrible, backwards, slippery slope that we should all oppose. And it doesn't matter who the speaker is. We have a right at a university to hear a diverse range of viewpoints and to get into dialogue and argument and conflict and contradiction. But the idea that the University of Illinois or the University of Wyoming or the University of Nebraska or Harvard, all of whom canceled talks that I was supposed to give, would bow down to that kind of pressure is just, to me, a really sad commentary. One that I write about is, you know, is we had a dinner. Vernon and I often kind of offer dinner at our home, cooked by us, as part of fundraising efforts. And so we offered one to a small group called the Public Square in Chicago, a group that we've been on the board for 10 years. And it was a kind of a crazy, magical moment. You undoubtedly read about it, where it was an online auction, and Tucker Carlson, the right-wing commentator, bought the dinner by pushing a button and buy instantly for $2,500. So there we were, confronted with not something that we imagined we would do. We thought we'd probably raise $300 and have some young people have dinner, but we ended up getting $2,500 and having dinner with six, you know, kind of aggressive right-wing reporters and pundits, one of whom was Andrew Breitbart. And several of our liberal friends kind of deserted us at that moment and said, you know, you can't do this, and it's bringing too bad attention onto the public square and the Illinois Humanities Council and so on. And so, again, I find that disappointing, but in the end, we did go through with it. In the end, it turned out fine. And in the end, those who were worried about us doing this said, great job. So it's bizarre.
There's also another part of this whole picture, which is, I can't remember exactly how you put it, but basically some angry dude with an email account can mount a campaign against you and be successful,
yeah.
And that success is made possible by the caution and cowardice that you were just talking about.
Right. I mean, I think that it's the kind of thing, if anybody stood up and said, I don't care, you can make all the accusations and threats and craziness you want, but this is what universities do. And I do document a couple of instances which made me very happy. One was at Millersville University, a public university in Pennsylvania, where the president of the university wrote a letter to the university community and explained what it means to be a free university in a free society, and that part of what you do is you welcome people who some folks find controversial. You welcome people who have what some people consider unpopular views, and you welcome them precisely because in a free society, transparency and open dialogue and open debate is the only way to come to any understanding of where we are. Look at where we are right now in terms of, say, whistleblowers and muckrakers. You know, we all praise Upton Sinclair and for the work he did, and Ida B. Wells for the work that she did. But it's harder to kind of wrap your mind around Edward Snowden or Chelsea Manning or Jeremy Hammond. But the truth is, Jeremy Hammond is a Chicago guy. You may not know his story, but he was sentenced last month to 10 years in prison for hacking. And when he was sentenced, the judge said to him, you're no Daniel Ellsberg. It turned out that Hammond had a relationship with Ellsberg, and Ellsberg was supporting his defense. But she said to him, you're no Daniel Ellsberg. And what kind of killed me about that comment was that Daniel Ellsberg wasn't Daniel Ellsberg when he was
right.
Daniel Ellsberg,
yeah,
if
yeah.
you follow what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. He was pilloried. He was prosecuted. He was charged with major crimes. But only 40 years later, we see, oh, I see. Well, he was right. He was right. Some of us knew he was right at the time. Or take the Media Pennsylvania break-in in 1971, the perpetrators of which have just become public. And even in President Obama's speech about security, he basically nodded in that direction and said they did a good thing. But it wasn't considered a good thing by the state, by the government, by the FBI, by the NSA. When they did it, every effort was bent to bring them to trial and to jail. Fortunately, they didn't, you know, they're the people who released the FBI files that showed that we were being spied on, that there was a program called COINTELPRO that was targeting black leaders, among other things. So these are things that, in retrospect, we can understand very clearly, but at the time that they're happening, we don't. And that's why we're at just one of those moments where here's here's the debate about Edward Snowden, and I think it's an important debate.
We're talking to Bill Ayers about his new book, Public Enemy. What happened after Obama's victory on election night 2008? Did the media circus go away?
Oh, yeah. The media circus completely went away. It just disappeared in a flash, and that was pretty sweet. And, you know, I didn't really hide out during those months. I didn't speak to the media, but I did teach my classes and go to work and ride my bicycle to the university and so on. I did all the things that I do, but I didn't speak to the media. But after the election, after one ecstatic night in Grant Park, downtown Chicago, ecstatic simply because all the nonsense was passing away, and I don't think we had any illusions that Barack Obama was going to be anything other than he advertised himself, but it was a pretty nice evening to see a million people converge in downtown Chicago, exactly the community I believe can exist and that is lying somewhere in our future, all ages, all genders, all races, coming together in a kind of quiet happiness. After that, I had an op-ed the next day in the New York Times, then I went on Terry Gross on NPR, then I did some media things. I went on Chris Matthews. I'd never heard of him before, and he was quite an interesting interview because he interviewed himself. I guess you've seen him. I kind of get a kick out of him, but he would ask me a question, then he'd answer it. And in the 5 minutes I was on, I probably spoke for 30 seconds. But anyway, I did do some media things, and then I went back to work, which is what I was doing during all that time anyway. And I think that you know, what continued, the media disappeared, but what did continue is the kind of hammering of this cartoon character, Bill Ayers, on, you know, kind of right-wing shows and Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and so on. And that continues to this day. I will occasionally get an alert, and there's Rush Limbaugh saying that Obama and I are best friends, and that I wrote his memoir, that I, you know, all these things are still in the air, in the fever swamps of the right-wing radio and the right-wing blogosphere, but they're not real. They're kind of fantasies of the right, and I pretty much don't notice them.
So the ongoing question that I think your memoir really invites us to think about is, how do we engage with the problems in our society, injustice, inequality, lack of real democracy, in an effective manner? And I was wondering how you are thinking about this now and how your thinking has changed since you were in the Weather Underground.
Well, I think that, you know, I think this book and Fugitive Days, both are attempts to grapple with, again, kind of a central question that has kind of driven me my whole adult life. And the question was first posed to me by the president of Students for a Democratic Society when I was 18 or 19 years old. And the question is, how do you live your life in a way that it doesn't make a mockery of your values? And the fact is that that's not a question that has a easy or simple or linear or straightforward answer. It's a question that one has to grapple with again and again. And while Fugitive Days was an attempt to answer that question by looking at how one very privileged young man, me, sat down in a landscape that was on fire, the mid-1960s, how he made his way without benefit of hindsight. And this memoir picks up from kind of the end of the American War in Vietnam, 1975, and asks the same question, but now over a much longer life, a longer span of time, and shifting conditions. So I think both books do attempt to raise the question, what are the limits of protest? What's effective? What's not effective? And I don't think there's any particular formula for it. There's certainly no recipe for it. But what I think that we have to do, all of us, is we have to follow a certain rhythm of being active citizens, being activists, being moral actors in our time. And that is, again, without having any easy or glib answers, it simply means opening our eyes, trying to see the world as it really is, paying attention to what's going on. And in an infinite and expanding universe, you can't pay attention once and then have it correct for the lifetime. You have to keep paying attention and keep reacting. And then after you open your eyes, you have to be astonished at both the beauty and the ecstasy that's everywhere in the world, and everything that human beings can do and create. It can be so magnificent and fantastic. And at the same time, you have to be astonished at the cruelty and the injustice that we visit upon one another. And then you have to act. You have to do something. You have to tell about it. And then you have to doubt if anything you did was worthwhile and or effective. And then you have to rethink the whole thing and start again. So that's my rhythm. Open your eyes, pay attention, be astonished, act, doubt, and repeat for a lifetime. That's what this book attempts to do. And in a funny way, you said before we went on the air, you know, that it's a lot more about parenting and teaching than you might have anticipated, certainly than I anticipated. But that's because for the last four decades, that's what I've done. You know, I've been a teacher and I've been a parent and now a grandparent. And a lot of the same moral issues that confront us on the big questions of war and peace also confront us on the everyday questions of what's fair and what's just and how do we want to live our lives and what lessons do we want to pass on to the young. Those are all things I think about. But back to your original question, I don't think of myself as a tactician particularly, so it's not really a book about tactics, and I don't really think much about tactics. I think in terms of, you know, what we need to do to speak honestly with one another and to make a world that's more balanced and more just and more peaceful and more transparent, more sustainable. And that's what I try to do every day.
Bill Ayers is an author, retired professor of education, co-founder of the Weather Underground. His new book is Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. And once again, he will be speaking this evening at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
I really appreciate it. Thanks so much. I look forward to seeing you tonight.